Shri Shukadeva Goswami
said,
Saha, he, evam, thus,
Bhagavan,
the great sage,
Krishtaha, being requested,
Kshatra by Vidura,
Kaushanavaha, Maitreya, Munihi,
the great sage,
Pumsam,
for all people,
Nisayasa,
for the greatest welfare,
Artena,
for that,
Tam,
under him.
Narrated,
Bahu,
greatly,
Manin,
honoring.
Translation. Shukadeva Goswami said, the great sage, Maitreya Muni, after honoring Vidura very greatly, began to speak at Vidura's request for the greatest welfare of all people. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The great sage Maitreya Muni is described here as Bhagavan because he surpassed all ordinary human beings in learning and experience. Thus his selection of the greatest welfare service for the world is considered authoritative. The all-inclusive welfare service for the entire human society is devotional service to the Lord and, as requested by Vidura, the sage described the same very appropriately. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Simati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivishesha Sunyavari Paschat Sadeva Chai Om Gyanam Timuran Dasya Shlokaya Shapsu Unmiritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Panchakalpa Rubyascha Kritya Sindhu Vyeva Chapatita Avnebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namaha. Nisrayasa Artha, that which is Pumsam Nisrayasa Artha, that purpose for which the greatest welfare for everyone. He's also in the previous verse, he's asked him to give us Hare Katam Eva Katha Susaram, narrations of the topics of the Lord, which are in fact Katha Susaram, the essence of all topics. He says, just as bees collect honey from flowers. For the sweetness is scattered around. They bring it all together, concentrated. That is to say, of course, Harikatha, the topics of the Lord. So Prabhupada says in the beginning of Bhagavatam, his introduction is in here. Let's see if I can find it. He has a very nice introduction to Srimad Bhagavatam, where he says, worth looking at, so we skip it, you know, we go to the verses and everything. Where he tells his purpose in translating Bhagavatam and bringing it. Here it is. He says, we must know, this is his preface, he calls it a preface. We must know the present need of human society. And what is that need? human society is no longer bounded by geographical limits to particular countries or communities. Human society is broader than in the Middle Ages, and the world tendency is toward one state or one human society. Well, this is certainly the condition of the modern world now. Even when I decided I had to, I was one of these people that was looking for truth. And I started out looking in a university department of philosophy. Spent 4 years studying what Prabhupada calls empiric philosophy. Found that it was the idea of looking for the truth was rejected from the very beginning. At the end of 4 years, I asked my best professor, I thought, my best professor, what can we achieve by studying philosophy? And he said, the best you can achieve is to be clear about what you're confused about. the best, he says, yes. So. One thing all the philosophers had in common is they hated religion. And so I decided to study religion. So I went to the university religion department. It was a new thing in America, this academic study of religion. I got the idea from Germany, actually. Religionswissenschaft was invented here. So exported to America. And so because there I thought, well, if I really want to study religion, I can't now look at just one religion that happens to be where I was born or what I was brought up in. And now, you know, we have to look at everything. You just can't look at one. So there was already, you know, that there was this notion, you know, why should I be restricted to one country or one community? I should look around and see everything that there is. Because with modern communications and transportations, like it or not, a lot of times we don't like it, but like it or not, we're all neighbors. No problem speaking to this modern, modern condition. Our tendency is one human society. Then Prabhupada continues, the ideals of spiritual communism. He introduces this notion here of spiritual communism. Other places he calls it Bhagavad communism. You know, and at the time Prabhupada was writing this, you also helps to know that this was the period of the Cold War, and India was more or less associated with Russia on that side. Because there was India and Pakistan were at odds with each other. And the United States was allied with Pakistan. Because Pakistan had a border with China. So India was allied with Pakistan. The United States was allied with Pakistan. Whereas India, there was therefore allied with Russia. So there was a big, at that time, in the 50s and 60s, all the economic aid, the engineers, all these things are all coming from Russia, in India. And so there's a great deal of Soviet ideology propagated at that time. So communism was a very good thing. And India. But Prabhupada wants to say the idea of spiritual communism. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, are based on more or less on the oneness of the entire human society, nay, of the entire energy of living beings. So first of all, not just the oneness of human society, but with all living beings. So right away, here is much broader a field for welfare. Not just welfare of human beings, but the welfare of all living beings. Broader. This is one thing of spiritual communism. The oneness. The need is felt by great thinkers to make this a successful ideology. Srimad Bhagavatam will fill this need in human society. It begins, therefore, with the aphorism, a sutra, one way to translate a sutra, an aphorism, a short pithy saying. With the aphorism of Vedanta philosophy, Janmadasa Yataha, Bhagavatam 111, to establish the ideal of a common cause. Janmadasa Yataha means that from which everything comes. So there's a common origin, a common center of maintenance, a common center through which we all go. A goal. Is also a common goal. Then he continues, human society at the present moment is not in the darkness of oblivion. It has made rapid progress in the field of material comforts, education, and economic development throughout the entire world. But there is a pinprick somewhere in the social body at large. And therefore there are large-scale quarrels, even over less important issues. There is a need of a clue as to how humanity can become one in peace, friendship, and prosperity with a common cause. So this is what Prabhupada wants to present, something around which all of humanity can actually become united. The ideology of material communism is not doing it. The ideology of capitalism is not doing it. But something is needed because we're coming together. There's all this material progress, but still large-scale quarrels. I mean, the 20th century, you know, is horrifying. It's just, this is the era of progress. You know, in the 19th century, everybody believed so much in progress. It was, we're going to make progress. We've never been. And what was the result of the progress? It was just this human beings destroying each other on an industrial scale as never before had been done. And when you look at this progress, you can say, that's progress, and why? And all we've done is learn how to murder each other better and more efficiently. Yeah. Right? So something's wrong, something's missing. And anybody with any brains can understand this. So what can we do? So Prabhupada wants to speak to this. He says, so we need to know how humanity become one in peace, friendship, and prosperity. So these are all welfare things. Peace is, everybody wants peace, everybody wants friendship, everybody wants prosperity. These are values everybody can agree upon, with a common cause, because there has to be a common center. And then here's this wonderful sentence. Srimad Bhagavatam will fill this need. For it is a cultural presentation for the re-spiritualization of the entire human society. What a phrase, huh? What a sense. First of all, it's a cultural presentation. Because it has to do with human culture. Prabhupada doesn't say it's a religious presentation. Because the term religion has become systematically corrupted. We don't understand the meaning of this term anymore. Prabhupada takes some effort in Bhagavatam to explain what dharma is. And this comes on this point, when at the beginning of this Bhagavatam, the sages in Naimisharanya Forest asked Sutta Goswami, there's different scriptures and they say different things. So even then, this is that problem was there. It's not just a modern problem, what they call religious pluralism, diversity. In the Vedas, Shruti Arvavina, the scriptures exist in different divisions. So it's not just to quote a text, because somebody can quote another text. This is a different thing. This is Yudhisthira's remark. So how do we know what is the best for all human beings? And of course the answer survived whom some Baroda Moyato Bhakti. That is best dharma for everybody, by which one can attain bhakti unto the transcendent Lord. Doesn't say Christianity or Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism or even Vaishnavism, if you take it in the sectarian sense, this group or that community. It means simply by wherever you find somebody can achieve bhakti. What is the standard of that bhakti? Unmotivated and uninterrupted. Wherever that is, we accept it. And Prabhupada explains this is actual dharma. It's not based on belonging to this group or that group. It's based on the soul. Prabhupada simply was not on the bodily platform. Sometimes we have to speak in a conventional way. But actually the real platform is not on the body. I saw this, one of my best moments was Srila Prabhupada was in another New York airport, and he had arrived, and devotees had come from all over. And in those days you could have a big reception in the airport, doing in the Vyasa Sana. Take over the whole concourse practically and do Guru Puja and everything. And, Prabhupada said there were so many garlands around him, up to his neck. And then he had a press conference. Porters came, they interviewed him. So all that happened, and then it was over, and Prabhupada was walking down the long hallway to concourse. And I was some, maybe 3 meters behind him, walking along. And then I could see beyond Prabhupada running toward us was a television reporter and his cameraman. They were late. They'd missed the press, interview. And it was a kind of a funny sight because they were running. And in those days, the television cameras were quite large. There's one guy has his big camera bouncing up and down on his shoulder, and then there's these wires and cords swinging back and forth. These guys are trotting up towards Srila Prabhupada. And they came in front of Prabhupada, just in front of Prabhupada, and Prabhupada stopped. And by the time I stopped, I happened to be standing right next to him. So I saw this up close, and so the cameraman, he's all out of breath, the interviewers, they're both of them panting.
from running, and the cameraman was untangling the cords, and the guy's getting his microphone and focusing, and he's putting his hair like this. This whole scene going on in front of Prabhupada, and then the interviewer takes the microphone and sticks it in front of Prabhupada's face, and he says to him, "How does your religion differ from other Buddhists?" This guy's really clueless. "How does your religion differ from other Buddhists?" And Prabhupada looked at him and he said, "We have nothing to do with this Hinduism or Buddhism. We are teaching the truth, and if you are truthful, you will accept it." And the guy had his mouth open for the next question, and it just stayed open. he was completely, his mind was just blown away. And I thought about this for such a long time, because I'm afraid, you know, my first response to that question was to say, well, you know, we maybe we're Hindus or something like that, you know. But then that wasn't right, kind of. You know, what would I say? I hadn't had the presence of mind to answer this question properly because of this Hinduism-Buddhism thing. But what Prabhupada did was completely just ignore the whole mental platform on which this question was asked. So here is a reporter, a television reporter, and he's doing the stupid job that reporters do. Take something and put it into some little box, give it a name, and then we've dealt with it. Huh? So what's your religion? Hindu. Okay, that's, we know that he's a Hindu. He's a Buddhist, this is that. What are these Hare Krishna's? It's a cult. Oh, okay. I understand. You know, you don't think about it. You just put it in a little box and you go on. So Prabhupada destroyed the boxes. He just simply, the whole platform of Hinduism, Buddhism, he just got rid of it in an instant, smashed it, and said, "We are teaching the truth." And then the next step was to look at the guy in the face and talk to him, not this reporter doing this thing, but this human being. "And if you are truthful, you will accept it." And the guy would just, you know, strip bare, all pretenses smashed away. Well, this is what his spiritual master is supposed to do. He just destroyed all of his maya. And the man was absolutely speechless. He just came up with something else, wouldn't it? So this is Dharma. It has nothing to do with this Hinduism or Buddhism. It has to do with yourself and your relationship to the truth and the truth of your life and how you're living it and what are you doing with yourself and so on. So this is Bhagavatam. It is a cultural presentation. And all human culture is supposed to be about this business. The achievement of the truth. Another time I was with Prabhupada, and there was a teacher from Columbia University. This was in New York. He was, I think, probably a graduate student or a young professor, fairly new. And he came to interview Srila Prabhupada, to talk to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said to him, "You know, what are you teaching?" And he said, I teach religion. And Prabhupada said, "So what is religion?" And he said, "Religion is a search for the divine." That's what and Prabhupada said to him, "Yes, it is, there is searching," he said, "but there is also finding." uh, And this part also is important, the search and the finding. People tend to believe, yeah, we're searching but nobody's finding. So the culture is one that leads people to the divine, because this is what human life is about. And if we ignore it, we will never become happy, we will never become satisfied. We will set up substitutes that fail us. There's a famous book about communism, for example, written in the 1930s. By early, you know, in the 1930s in Europe, in America, 20s and 30s, you couldn't be an intellectual unless you were a communist. Everybody had to be a communist. It was like such a big intellectual fad. And so people became communists right and left. You know, it was idealism and all the stuff, and it was going to be the evils of exploitations of capitalism and so on. And people really bought into it, that, you know, Marx had really discovered some truths about human society and so on. But then people began to get disillusioned, especially in the 30s in Spain, when World War II was rehearsed in some ways. People saw what was going on in Russia also. So the book was about communism, was called The God That Failed. So it's a God, or a God substitute. So people, in some ways, the traditional religion of the West had been rejected or lost. And then it was replaced by various kind of substitutes, ideologies, kind of secular substitutes for religion. They also failed. So still, what to do? So Prabhupada wants to introduce Srimad Bhagavatam to really bring out, let people know what is it, not that we're bringing in some import from Hinduism. Is the real religion. And it doesn't have to do with this Hinduism or Buddhism or Christianity. And because it is the real religion, it deals with the entire human society, not just this part or that part. See, in the West, our idea of religion, this is a product of what they call secularization. A gradual historical process where religion gradually becomes isolated from other concerns. Now we think of religion as something that's added on to our lives. Do you have a religion? Yes, I do. I have a religion. And it's something I do once a week on Sunday. Something off to the side. When we do our ordinary activities, the really important things in life, such as using political power, making money, we keep religion out of it. And so you can be as religious as you want, you just keep it in its place, something you do at the side. So it's more or less a kind of hobby. Just like a person may be devoted in his private time to making little model airplanes, or collecting stamps it's a little obsession. And there's other people that have that same obsession, and they have their associations and their mailers, their stamp collecting, or model airplanes, or model trains, or whatever it may be. They have a hobby that they engage in. But that's their thing, and then otherwise they go to work or they do other things, and it's off to the side. So religion is something like that. You can be as religious as you want, just don't let it interfere with our worldly activities. I keep it to the side. But Prabhupada's talking about the re-spiritualization of the entire human society. This is really a revolution. Really a revolution. And I tell you, we're afraid of this. At least I am. I mean, because right now, you see what's happened in the world, is there are those people who now want to bring religion into the marketplace and into government, right? We call them fundamentalists. And we're all scared. And I must say, this is my big doubt about Srimad Bhagavatam, about Krishna consciousness. I did not read the first canto of Bhagavatam until I moved into the temple. At the time I was getting involved in Krishna consciousness, what was available was the second canto. When books started, when Bhagavatam started to be published in America, they what was called ISKCON Press, the BBT didn't yet exist as such, but there was something called ISKCON Press. It was in Boston. Later moved to New York. They published individual paperback chapters of the second canto. So the first thing I read was the second canto. Every few months another chapter came out, paperback book. The first canto, because Prabhupada had been translating that, and that was published first, the first canto was already published in India. And all that was available at first was the three copies, the collection of store, bunch of books that Prabhupada had brought from India, these three volume sets. And so devotees had them, but they were no longer available for selling or distribution. So I didn't read the first canto until I moved into the temple. Because it was the one that was printed in India. And that was being edited again. For publication in the West, because it's full of typographical errors and Prabhupada's sort of original English, which has a lot of power but is not standard English. We actually lost something, because I'll never forget that reading of this first canto in the original edition, because Prabhupada's voice really came through. Though it was Indian English, it wasn't standard English at all. It's the kind of English that Indian people talk to each other. It was a little different language than but boy, it was so powerful. I was really affected by it. Anyway, I came to the part in the third volume, where we deal with Maharaj Hath Maharaj, actually dealt with the age of Kalima. And Prabhupada there says that, makes it very clear, that he says, and in the original it was in boldface type, you know, black type. He says, no, because he's talking about how Maharaj Prakshit actually, as the government, was to uphold Dharma. That's what the whole chapter is about. It's to uphold Dharma. And Prabhupada says, in boldface, no religious principles or ideology can progressively advance without the support of the government. And government means the resort to force. That's what a government is. Kshatriya means that they have like James Bond, the license to kill. That's what it means. And when I read that, I was really dumb. Because that's what you're just afraid of. And I've been in the Hare Krishna movement long enough to be scared by certain devotees. I had devotees that I thought were really scary people. And I thought that if I was ever looking down the barrel of a gun, the guy on the other end would have T-lock on it. There were some fanatical devotees, and just out of their minds. And that plus, just my general idea of, this thing of religion getting a government, that's really the cause of so many troubles. We got to keep religion out. Because one religion gets in power, the first thing they're going to do is, persecute everybody else. That's why, at least in America, they're all a little worried about these born-again Christians, because although they share some values with us, we have the idea that if they take control, they're going to have our burning at the stake in the town squares all over there. They'll have our uses there. And so we want to keep them outside. But then I thought, okay, this is what Prabhupada says, and I can see it. Yeah, if Bhagavatam is describing the reality, and that the point of human life is to go back to Godhead, and the business of the government to secure the welfare of the people, how can it neglect their welfare? We know what their welfare really is. The problem is people don't know what their welfare is. It's unclear about, aside from economic advancement. That much everybody agrees on. But beyond that, in their spiritual welfare, the government says we don't have anything to do with it. But that's really neglecting that as purpose. So I could see that actually Prabhupada was, everything followed quite logically. Yeah, so then I happened to be with Prabhupada, also in New York. Prabhupada started the political party in God We Trust Party for Purified Leaders, a short-lived but interesting period in Islam's history. It was his idea. He gave it the name, the In God We Trust Party for Purified Leaders. And I was one of the people I was running for Congress. Balavanta was one of the instigators of this, the starters of it, and he was there with Prabhupada and I wanted to, with me, we were together, and Prabhupada wanted to talk to us, and we went back into his room. And Prabhupada said, Balavanta said, Balavanta had just been running a campaign, and he was quite frustrated by certain things. Then he said to Prabhupada, what happens when we preach and we preach and we preach, and people still don't accept? And Prabhupada said, then there must be argumentum ad baculum. This is in logic. There's this, one of the fallacies, actually. Logically, it's a fallacy. The resort to force. We're having a logical argument, and I'm trying to defeat you, it's an argument about baculum. Baculum, Prabhupada said, baculum means stick. And then a couple was there with their child, and the child was grabbing things on Prabhupada's desk, and they were trying to keep him from grabbing things. And Prabhupada said, just that little boy, You say, don't touch, don't touch, don't touch, and finally he still touches, slap on the hand. He said, so baculum means stick. And then he looked at us and he said, oh my God, And when I tell you, my heart sank. And he said, therefore, there should be a war. He said. He said, where these wars, he said, where the demons fight the demons, nothing is accomplished. But if you have one side that's Krishna conscious, the other side's demon. He said to him, that is Krishna consciousness. And then he went like this. Then he went, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, that is Krishna consciousness. And he was laughing all the time. That is Krishna consciousness. But he's talking to us, we're in his political party, so he's telling us that there will be a war. So at this point, in my mind, my doubt came up. I've never talked to anybody. I have to say that in the early days of the Krishna consciousness movement, it was not permissible to have doubts. Somewhere it says, Prabhupada, it's mentioned in the early part of the Gita, that doubts are like demons. So somehow or that was mostly understood that anyone who has a doubt is a demon. Anyway, you couldn't bring up your doubts if people would just slam you for having doubts, you know. So I had this doubt, but I couldn't really talk about it. But at this point, I had to say something to Prabhupada. And so this is how I put it. I said, Srila Prabhupada, you envision a time when devotees will command armies and run countries. No, that's right. Become successful. You envision a time that devotees will command armies and run countries. He said, yes. I said, then, in that case, how can we be sure that we won't become demons? And Prabhupada said, now chant 16 rounds and follow the four regulative principles. And I said, and that's enough? And he said, yes, that's enough. I was satisfied with that answer. I was really happy that he didn't say something, you know, a little abstract or hard to measure. 16 and 4, you know, it's just concrete, it's there, it's like that. So the fact is that there's power in the world. Somebody's going to exercise that power. They're going to exercise that power with certain ideas in mind. You can say, oh, power is evil, it's not spiritual, we leave it alone, but it's Krishna's power. To do anything in the world, you need power. But we have this saying in English, you know, power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. So power corrupts. Prabhupada said, the saying in essence, no. Not but you chant 16 rounds a day and follow the four regulative principles. Well, I thought about this for a while. And I think I would add a phrase to it. You chant 16 rounds and follow the four regular principles in a sustainable way. That you chant your rounds so that you can chant them every day. That is to say, you actually follow the process of Krishna consciousness. You chant while trying to give up offenses. Later on in my career in Krishna consciousness, I ran into abuses of power. And I did, in fact, you know, put down the barrel of a gun with feet up in the other end, not quite literally, but close enough. So I've seen this, but in every case I've seen that, I found a problem in this area. It was actually not happening, the chanting of the 16 rounds, and the chanting of the following four regular principles. All right, I think this is the correct I believe Prabhupada on this. Still, we have to be very careful. We have to be careful also to be on the Krishna conscious platform, that is, not on the bodily platform. We really have to have nothing to do with this Hinduism or Buddhism or this group or that group. We have to understand Krishna consciousness. And this is the other very important part of Prabhupada's mission, is the science of self-realization. We have to understand that it is a science. It's not a religion, one religion among other religions, a religion as opposed to some knowledge or something else. It is simply a science. And it is the highest science. It's the science of self-realization. Science means that people accept it the way today everybody accepts science, right? Everybody, material science is everywhere. It's not considered by most people to be an ideology. In fact, it is packaged in an ideology, very much so. We could call it scientism. And in fact, the ideology of scientism is probably causing most of the troubles right now. Because this progress notion is part of this ideology. And scientism is the idea that through material science we can completely control material nature, and we can mold it and shape it to do anything we want. In other words, we can take God's place. That's really what the project is. That's why everybody's really enthusiastic about science. It's more power, more control over material nature. Yeah, this is scientism. So that's the problem. But Krishna consciousness is actually, we have to understand it as a science, and people have to understand it as science. As real science, actual knowledge. Science also means that it is applied. This is the important part of it. Ultimately, people will be convinced about Krishna consciousness when they see that it works in practice. In other words, science means vijnana. There's jnana and there's vijnana. Knowledge and realization. So that when we study Bhagavatam, we have a history of our tradition of people exploring and discovering the Supreme. Our predecessors have had direct experiences with the Divine, Parashara Baba. Their experiences have been recorded. And they have also shown us how to, at the same time, repeat those experiences in our own generation, generation after generation. This is the meaning of parampara. That there are the spiritual experiments, you could say, or experiences of predecessors, starting with Brahma. We have in the second canto his direct perception of Krishna. We have Narada Muni, we have Vyas. All down the line we have it there. And they have passed it down to us and given us the methods by which we also can have the same experience. That's the science. And actually, the one forum in which this experience is to take place is Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada says later on, he says in the first canto, into the third chapter, one can see Krishna directly in the pages of Bhagavatam. Directly. The book becomes transparent. If the speakers and the hearers are qualified, if we can hear with rapt attention, but to hear that way, Prabhupada says, one has to be pure in mind. To be pure in mind, we have to be pure in action. To be pure in action, we have to be pure in eating, sleeping, bathing, and defending. So, ultimately, Krishna consciousness will work when we actually practice it. If we don't practice it, then it becomes one of those things that's just another disturbance in human society. And it's always a little scary because things can go wrong. We see that things have gone wrong in our movement. It's our business to prevent them from happening. It's not just any other people's business. It's each devotee's business. That we take this Krishna consciousness very seriously, because some energy has been released into the world. When Mahaprabhu came, some energy has been released. And it's spiritual energy. And that energy is moving. And it has to become, it has to be received and acted within in a proper way. Otherwise, also some damage can be there. So this is a big responsibility for us. We do not want to see this become perverted or misused in any way, because ultimately this energy is there and there's a certain amount of power, and that power has to be directed in a pure way. And if we follow Prabhupada's instructions very carefully, it will work. Maybe any questions or comments? Yeah.
Right now, like especially in Europe, and I also think in America, you see like the Muslim community is growing so much, and like when you look in the media, there's always, you can always find something about some power, like in Egypt, they go to also in the government, like the fundamentalists and everything, which is quite scaring. And
yeah, cheers me up.
And so it's like, why is it growing so much? Like you said, like when people are convinced that it works, they see it works, then they will understand. But like there are so many people joining in this fundamentalistic Muslim religion, and why is there so much power in there?
Yeah, because this is the power, as far as I can see, in these fundamentalism. The first motive is fear. The nature of modernism has been defined like this. All that is solid melts into the air. Then they didn't call Marxism, like all the modern world. All that is solid melts into the air. The nature of the modern world is dissolving traditional cultures and moralities. There's a kind of international culture which seems to leave us all uprooted, and with a great deal of material facility but no idea what we're supposed to do with our lives at all. All that is solid melts into the air. It's all knowledge itself is in doubt. The Irish poet Yeats wrote this poem about the modern world. He says that things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loose upon the world. And then he says, that the best people, the best lack all conviction, and the worst are full of passionate intensity. So this is the condition. Because some people, they just have no idea of what's true or any truth. There's no truth. Everything's true. Nothing's true. And some people in this, they have nowhere to go. They have nothing to hang on to. And they're angry. They're upset. They're resentful. They feel somebody's doing this to us. Somebody's destroying our traditional way of life. And so these fundamentalisms of the appeal to those people is fear and it's resentment, as far as I can see. I spent some bad time thinking whether is Krishna consciousness another fundamentalism or not, because I've met fundamentalist devotees, that's for sure. But it is not. Because you do not see in these fundamentalisms any understanding other than centered around our group. And our group exists by virtue of being against every other group. There is a thing called fundamentalist Hinduism. It has a name, Hindutva. Hindu-ness, or Hinduism there, Hindutva. Anyway, the Sanskrit suffix twa is like the English N-E-S-S. Hinduness, huh? Hindu twa. And in India, many of our congregation, they call them right-wing Hindu, and they're militants. They also bomb. Actually, suicide bombing was invented by Indians, by Tamil Tigers. Of course, they're Marxists, really. That's where it started. They're violent. Here's the stuff goes on in India: it's communal violence between Hindus and Muslims all the time, and they like ISKCON. They do. They really like us. Yeah, I tell you why too. Because they see that what we do is we convert Christians to Hindus. We convert Christians. It's payback, you see. Because a big issue for them is Hindu missionaries, and then they convert again. So we get back. So this is their platform. And I've talked to these people. In fact, some GBC sat down and talked to the representative of the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, which is an international branch of this. I mean, they're different. Some are worse than others, but anyway, the Hindu Vishwa Parishad. And they wanted to know that they didn't think we were sufficiently committed to the word Hindu. But I got the impression that, you know, one of the meanings of Hindus is you hate Muslims. And of course, you know, I mentioned in the earlier lecture, I grew up with these fundamentalist Christians. And their idea of other religions, this is their very early idea, is that other religions is not that they're worshipping nothing, they're worshipping demons. That, you know, in the early Christianity, there's a temple of Apollo or Athena or something, one of the Romans or Greek gods, you know. It wasn't that that god was an imaginary being. That god was a devil who'd taken this form to delude people. That's the theory of other religions. So there's this extremely narrow sectarian self-identity based on hostility toward other people, without any idea of what Prabhupada has described and what I was reading as the common cause.
So when you hear like a sentence like we don't have to do with religion, we talk about the truth for others, it sounds also like
So they have to understand. You can't just say that.
Yeah.
You have to explain to people why we say that, and what is actually the meaning of religion. If we want to say we do, we don't want. We use the word, but we're careful to understand what we mean. Yeah.
But now, how do you expect Krishna consciousness to have this unifying effect for humanity that is presented in such a specific cultural way, like it's embodied in such a specific cultural way as we are presenting?
Yeah, but even not everybody has to do that. I noticed that when Prabhupada would deal with Christians, he did not tell them they had to stop being Christians. He talked to them in such a way that, for example, you should chant the names of God and stop eating meat, or at least stop killing cows. If they did these things, for whatever reason, they would become better Christians. As they became better Christians, they would become better Hare Krishnas, automatically. So, we don't say that everybody has to join our particular community and worship in our temples, but the general principles of religion, cleanliness, austerity, mercifulness, and truthfulness, these things have in common. So, those who wish to become part of this particular specific tradition, this way of doing things, that is all right. We welcome that. But I would feel much better, for example, if we had a person who understood Krishna consciousness, who was, say, a Christian priest or something, establishing that within his own community. That would make me happier. And I think I engage in this Vaishnava Christian dialogue. We understand now the principles of bhakti as a general mode of spirituality. We understand the difference between being a personalist and impersonalist. And well, I think gradually people can grow together.
I just wanted to tell on this point that we distributed in Augsburg, and I met one preacher in the Catholic church, and he told me that he had Prabhupada books he received on the streets, and he put it lectures from Prabhupada in his lectures.
I think that's a real achievement. Uh-huh.
That was very nice.
I also met a Benedictine monk. He was saying that the speech he gave him once Bhagavad Gita, he was so fired up that he wanted to have faith. And he was all happy to meet me and get Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, you see? Because there are within Christianity, you know, there are many Christians that, as Prabhupada described it, Jesus died for my sins so I can go on sinning. We have a counterpart sitting on the string and chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. It's a similar offense. But they also have their serious people who are serious about spiritual life. And those people may exist within and within other traditions also. And we want to see those people become stronger and more clear. And then someday, you know, everybody will recognize each other. Hey! And anyway, there's a long discussion with that, and now we should start and stop and honor Prasadam so we can have our meeting begin at 10 o'clock. Okay. Thank you very much. Shubha Prabhupada.